all main property taxpayers, or their main taxpayers, all individuals, overwhelmingly. I'd like to ask Senator Perry, the principal PAC opposing Tabor is called Citizens Unified for Maine's Future, yet when you look at the PAC reports, there are no citizens. It is all union money. Money from away. The National Education Association has dumped hundreds of thousands of dollars into this. The Service Employees International Union from Washington, D.C. has dumped hundreds of thousands of dollars into this. And frankly, the SEIU seems to be tied up with ACORN at the national level. This is money that's flowing in from away. It has nothing to do with citizens putting their money up to work honestly in on a referendum question. Could you please explain to me why it is that you think Tabor is an alien thing when all of the money that is opposing Tabor is coming from non-citizen, non-state sources?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question because I have no idea where the money's coming from on either side. I'm not involved in that level. I'm involved with the constituents of my district when I go door to door and meet them and see them constantly year round. I know they've rejected Tabor twice. I know property taxes are their biggest concern. I know Tabor will be a massive shift onto property taxes over time. You know, as far as where the money's coming, I'm just not involved on that level. I've never looked at the right. You're involved with Tabor, and I hear constantly out of your organization, we're spending out of control. You know, they want to get your hands in your pocket. They keep increasing spending. That's simply not the case. I never hear a lot of numbers. I hear when people challenge that, I hear attacks back on the people who do it. You know, well, you can't trust them. They wanted to have a local option sales tax, or you can't, this guy voted for the healthcare tax. You know, it sounds like we can't even discuss if there's better ways of doing things. I know hundreds of thousands of dollars, I learned that today, came from out of state to get this thing on the ballot in the first place. I know that much. So I've been told. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I've heard. Hundreds of thousands of dollars came from out of state, from three different groups, Chicago, California, Virginia, through the Heritage Center to buy these signatures. Okay, so that goes on in this stuff. There's questions everywhere, of different interests. That goes on. That's part of the process. But I can't answer anything beyond that.
Thank you. Are there people in the audience who'd like to ask questions of our panel members? And if so, can you come up to one of the two microphones?
To the microphone, I'd like to invite anybody else who plans to ask a question to come up closer so that we don't have big silent spaces in between questioners.
We can fill them if you need to. We don't seem to have a problem.
Yeah, I'd like to compliment the panel on having an intelligent, respectful discussion, sharing ideas even though you don't agree. One question I have is on the excise tax. I believe that's question two. And isn't that just a Tabor in sheep's clothing? I've heard that.
What's your name
and where are you from? Oh, Paul Lebo from Bucksport.
Was that addressed to anyone specifically?
Was that addressed to any particular person?
To everybody, because I misread it at first and thought it was a referendum on clean energy, clean cars, and heard a totally different message from some Democrats that I talked to.
Okay, well, this is a discussion about Tabor. First of all, I didn't come here prepared to discuss the excise tax. So I don't know if it's my place to toss the question if somebody else has something to say.
Yeah, the excise tax initiative does two things. It cuts the rate of the excise tax for at the beginning of, and again, I'm not an expert on this either. I've done more Tabor than excise, but it does have an excise tax cut, and it also has a green initiative in it.
Responding.
I'm sorry. It also does have a green initiative where it cuts the sales tax on fuel efficient vehicles, and it cuts the vehicle excise tax for the first 3-4 years, something like that, for those vehicles. So it has those two components together. So it's a combination.
I think,
but this, I wasn't involved in the development.
Sorry, Steve.
Oh, go ahead.
I think
this is Garrett.
In terms of your question, at least as I understand it, it's not necessarily a Tabor-like situation in the sense that you're having people have to vote or approve on a regular basis what's going on with the excise tax. I do think what bears mentioning with regard to the excise tax is that who it benefits most are new car owners. You know, people who have cars that are 6 years old or less, I believe. And in the state of Maine, at least, you know, 60% of the cars that are out on the roads are much older than that. The other thing that's interesting about the excise tax question, and again, I don't think any of us were prepared necessarily to come and debate that per se, but is that while it has been billed as a green initiative, there's a subtle irony in that a Cadillac Escalade, which is an $80,000 car, an SUV that's a hybrid, and has much more impact on the roads, actually gets worse miles per gallon than, say, a Ford Focus, it will be exempt from the tax as envisioned, whereas a smaller, more fuel-efficient car that has less wear and tear on the road is not. So there's significant debate, at least in the environmental community, about whether or not this truly is a green initiative. So.
Well, and I'd just like to weigh in. Thank you for the question. The only connection I see between this... The only link I see between this and Tabor, it's another massive shift onto property taxes. 68% of cars and 68% of cars, 68% of cars in Bangor and 68% of cars statewide do not get any reduction. They're at the bottom mill rate. This cuts the mill rates in half on the upper mill rates the first 5 years. 68% of cars get no break whatsoever. In Bangor, it would cost $1.8 million in revenue, and the vast majority, or nearly half of that, would go to the rental car companies at the airport, not even to our citizens here. Now, we've got to make up the $1.8 million for this. In both of my cars, I'm not getting a break, and 68% of us don't. So the only connection I see, it's another shift onto property taxes.
Thank you. Can you give us your name and where you're from?
Hi, my name is Adam. I live in Monroe. I'm a taxpayer and citizen in the state of Maine, and we're talking about a taxpayer's bill of rights, Tabor. And I'm not horribly educated on the details on both sides. Actually, thank you both sides for coming and doing this, but I have one question, and I don't know if it falls into this debate or not, but we're talking about spending at the government level and how these funds are allocated and so on and so forth, and who's responsible and who's being negligent and so on. And I'm concerned about the people who can't really help themselves and some of the things that the government does do in this state for people who can't help themselves, namely elderly children in school and mental health. Mental health is a big one right now to me because the state of mental health in this state is not very good as far as taking care of those with mental illness. It seems very overcrowded, very underfunded, and miserable. It seems bad. And I was concerned about if this Tabor Bill of Rights comes into effect, what kind of effect that'll have on the mental health especially, and also others that we take care of because they cannot take care of themselves. They don't have a choice. We talk about liberty, and we talk about a well of virtue. I want to know about these areas in particular. So,
is there someone particular you'd like to have answer that question?
I'm putting it out to both sides, so either anyone's good. So,
somebody
thanks.
Interested in starting?
I'll start, but you guys can.
Well, I don't think there's anyone David Crocker responding. I don't think there's anyone on the Tabor side who would dispute that there are certain people who are genuinely impaired or helpless or in need that shouldn't receive assistance. I think the question is, what is the scope of disability, and what are the reasonable and rational things that we should be doing for ourselves? And what are those things that government should assist us with? We have a very large budget with the Department of Health and Human Services in Maine. It's around $850 million. It's very large. It's one of the largest, you know, budgetary items in the state budget. We currently have about 22% of the state that's on Medicaid at this point. And that particular number of people on Medicaid was increased recently in conjunction with the passage of the Dirigo health bill. And it was done as a matter of policy by, lowering the threshold, actually, of eligibility. And so, my answer to your question, to be very succinct, would be, yes, we need to assist people who genuinely need help, but we need to encourage those who can to do, and we should provide the kind of economy over time that allows people to do, to have the kind of jobs and income so that they can actually stand on their own two feet without assistance from other people. So, sure, help those in need, but let's be careful and let's be cautious about how we do it.
Is there someone else who'd like to comment on this?
Sure, thank you.
Mr. Perry?
Yes, thank you. You're absolutely right. This has been, the issue of mental health is it, and the systems in place and the funding, what we can offer, is a serious lack right now. I used to serve on the OPEGA committee, and I'll never forget this day. We had a meeting, I think it was last summer or the summer before, to go down and get a report back on why there's no beds available at the Riverview Psychiatric Center. And I was watching the morning news that morning. The day I'm going down to hear this report, there were three news stories that morning, all in the same broadcast, three separate news stories representing eight murders in the state of Maine, all by people who are suffering from mental illness, and three of them were family members. Obviously, things are going on here in the state of Maine in ways it wasn't in the past. We closed down the institutions. We went to a more community-based system that's probably a better system. The integration is certainly the way to go, but you've got to have follow-up and care available to people if that's a system we're going to go with. And I think we implemented this system before everything was in place. Now, I heard earlier that we've never had an honest conversation of the priorities of spending here in the state of Maine. And when I look at Senator Rosen and the rest, I hate to keep going back to you, Senator Rosen, but you work tirelessly with the rest of the Appropriations Committee, going line by line through our priorities and trying to figure out the way to put a budget together, and you're still doing it to figure out how we're going to deal with the $200 million shortfall that still exists because of this economy, not because of the size of our budget. I also heard Tabor doesn't take us backwards, okay? That's right. But it's locking us in the worst recession since the Great Depression. Tabor wasn't a problem in Colorado when inflation was going along and population growth in that region was going along. It wasn't until they got into a recession that they had to suspend this thing because it was a disaster. We're asking to vote this in now in the worst recession since the Great Depression, and we're going to lock in all these problems is what's going to happen. So I'm very concerned about what's going on in mental health. And I don't see this doing anything, Tabor doing anything, to help that.
Mr. Bowen, do you have something you'd like to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that according to the Census Bureau, we're about 11th in terms of our tax burden as a percent of our sort of personal income, which is high. What that means, though, is that there are states across this country, 39 other states across this country, that educate their kids, that pave their roads, that operate state parks, and that take care of folks that are truly needy, and do so without taking as much money out of the pockets of their people as Maine does. We've been, this idea persists in this state that somehow we have to spend this money, that somehow we're destined to be a high tax state. You know, I read in the Bangor Daily the other day, the editorial page, which I can barely bring myself to read anymore, but, we're a big, sparsely populated state, so we're just going to have to pay high taxes. Well, look, we're not a large state. We're the 39th largest state. And there are a dozen states that are less sparsely populated than Maine is. A dozen. Not one of them has a higher tax burden than Maine does. Not one. Not the Dakotas. I mean, You name it. So I just don't buy this idea that we have to spend this and that we've cut everything to the bone and that there's no other choice at this point. And I don't think we've had that discussion, Senator Perry. I mean, I came into, this is going to be, I don't know how much time are we timed on this, but I'll just tell a quick story. I served in the legislature with Senator Perry. I believe you and I came in together in 2002, right?
I'd been there for a little while.
Oh, okay.
We spent a few years together.
We did, yeah. I came in when Governor Baldacci came in 2002, and we had a $1 billion shortfall. We'd gone from $250 million surplus in 2000 to a shortfall. And I thought, you know, this is going to be great. We are going to have this discussion. We really are going to sit down and say, now look, in the late 90s, when we had all the money coming in, we spent and spent and spent and spent. And now we're facing this massive shortfall because we overspent. So now we're going to have a discussion about, okay, what is it that we can do and what is it that we can't do? And we're really going to have that discussion. We're going to set goals. We're going to be disciplined about it. And that's what I thought we were going to do. And we didn't do that. What we did to balance those budgets was a lot of one-time money. We refinanced a bunch of debt. We cleaned out reserve funds. We eliminated vacant government positions where the position was paid for, but nobody was working there. We sold off the liquor business. We extended the payback schedule on the unfunded liability of the pension system, which makes future generations pay for that. But we sort of did a lot of one-time things and sort of muddled through. And we never did have that discussion about, can we afford to have the highest percent of a population on Medicaid of any state? We have more people on Medicaid as a percent of the population than any state in this country. We have the second highest number of people on food stamps as a percent of the population of anybody in this country. This just came from Census Bureau 3 weeks ago. We have the second highest number of people on food stamps, welfare. I mean, we've made a choice to grow government to this size. And what we're saying, what Tabor does, is it says, look, we're going to ask you to be a little more careful about living within your means and making those choices and saying we've got to come up with some other health care solutions besides putting a quarter of the population of the state on Medicaid, because those programs are being cut. I did a report earlier this year, you can find on our website, looking at what's happened to Medicaid over the last few years. And what we did is we put all these people on Medicaid, and then we started cutting their services. We started cutting their access to care because we couldn't afford it. We had to ration care to people on Medicaid. People struggled to find a doctor who were on Medicaid because we put so many people on it. And then we go to budget time, and I'm a fan of Senator Rosen as well, the fount of all wisdom. And so what happens is you do get cuts to folks that are truly needy. So we see Tabor as a way of saying, look, we're gonna have to be very, very careful. And if we need to grow programs to help people, then let's talk, let's go to the public, let's say, look, here's what we're going to do with these programs. We're going to grow them by this much. This is how that money's going to be invested. You know, and let's talk to the public about that, involve them in this discussion. But most states provide the services that the state of Maine provides and do it with less money coming out of their pockets and have more robust economies as a consequence. And more prosperity.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, did you want to comment on this?
Well, we might as well make it a full house.
Right.
Adam, thank you for your question. I guess the way I look at it a little bit is I married a Yankee. I'm from the South originally. And we moved here from Mississippi. Living in a place like Mississippi, which makes very different choices than we have made in the state of Maine, in terms of how we work with, support, recognize the economic impacts of folks with mental health issues, folks with other health issues. I have certainly come to appreciate the choices and the values that we uphold as a state. And in truth, when you travel around this country, in the work that I do at least, around community economic development, people look at us as a model of a state that is compassionate, and at the same time as a state that has some of the best work ethic and hardest working people around. So that said, I think you raise a very important point. And the truth of the matter is we are a state that's getting older. We are a state that will continue to face, along with other states, issues of how do you care for people in need. And it's not just people who could be easily stereotyped. It's people who have genuine issues that are chronic in nature, and that merit some support. The fact remains, in our view, that Tabor, rather than come in with a scalpel and say, what are the ways we can make deliberate choices that serve us all better, it comes in with a hatchet by putting into place this arbitrary formula that over time is going to make it increasingly difficult to make the funding choices that we need to make to ensure that, that we're not making sort of cuts arbitrarily or on a formula basis. So it's certainly our belief that over time, Tabor is going to have adverse consequences for the programs and services that we currently, as a state, as a people, have decided are important to provide to ensure that everyone in the state has an opportunity to prosper and to contribute to our mutual and shared prosperity. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who has a question they'd like to address to the panel?
Well, seeing no audience members yet at the microphone, and wanting to put a special bit of encouragement out there to Senator Rosen, who's been referred to several times today, but the members of the listening audience on the radio haven't heard from him, and the rest of us know that he is truly here. Please come up and make a statement if you'd like to, and in response to all that you've heard
into this thing
here, and also invite anybody else in the audience. If you don't have a question and you just want to make a statement or offer your opinion, we'd like to hear that as well. In the meantime, I'd like to ask the panelists about something I know just a tiny bit about. I've been out of state, and I just came back and saw a headline about some legal action that's being taken by supporters of Tabor 2 against the state legislature for having meetings and using state money to discuss this issue. Can anyone clarify that for me, please?
Yeah, we...
This is Steve Bowen.
This is Steve Bowen. Thank you. From Maine Heritage. Yeah, my organization and the Tabor campaign this morning asked the Attorney General to undertake an investigation of what we thought to be the improper use of legislative, essentially legislature's time, the legislative building, legislative staff. And that comes from a meeting that took place on August 12th in Speaker Pingree's office. We found out right before that meeting that the meeting was taking place. It was a private meeting behind closed doors. The campaign, the Tabor campaign, did a freedom of access request, requesting any and all documents and materials related to that meeting and sort of the broader anti-Tabor campaign. You'll see the news reports tonight, and you can see the documents that have been posted online, the emails that were turned over as part of the Freedom of Information Act request. And essentially, the story appears to go like this. A lobbyist who was a former chief of staff for the Senate president, mm-hmm, organized a meeting in Speaker Pingree's office with folks from the construction, road construction, and engineering communities. The documents seem to indicate that the intent of that meeting was to raise money from these folks to oppose the Tabor question, raise money for the campaign, and also that it appears to suggest that the Speaker and the Senate President told these folks that if Tabor and excise and the excise tax initiative were to pass, they would not do anything to make sure that these folks got more funding. They seem to have hinted, and this is in the email traffic, that a gas tax might be in the offing after Tabor and excise tax were defeated. This meeting seems to have been a campaign meeting and seems to have discussed fundraising and campaign activities. It was done in Speaker Pingree's office at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday. It involved members of the legislative staff in both the Senate and the House, in the Senate President's office and the Speaker's office. There are emails using legislative email accounts in which staff members in both the House and Senate, in the President's office and the Speaker's office, were coordinating with this outside lobbyist to coordinate this meeting. For those of you that aren't familiar with sort of the finance laws, I mean, the legislature is paid for by you. The legislature spends, I don't know what the budget is now. It's got to be $30 million over the biennium, something like that. So that's your, you paid for that building, you pay the salaries of all the legislative staff, it's your money, and so it is therefore illegal to use, you know, to use the Speaker of the House's office and her staff and the Senate President's staff and use their emails and computers and telephones to organize a campaign meeting. Now, we don't know exactly what happened in that meeting. There were no memos turned over as part of the Freedom of Information Act request. There was no press involved. It was specifically, there was instructions in those emails to make sure that the press did not attend the meeting. It was not announced as a public meeting, and it was taking place in the legislature. So, and the ultimate result of the meeting, it would appear, is that members of that group of industry folks who were at the meeting then turned around and made contributions to the campaign against Tabor and the excise tax campaign as well, to the tune of, I want to say, how much was it, David?
Oh, gosh.
I want to say almost $60,000.
Yeah.
That's what happened today. We're concerned. I mean, as David pointed out, we're fighting an uphill battle here. We're being outspent about 20-1. So the other side has spent about $2 million, almost all of which has come from out of state. We've spent. $100,000, maybe, not quite, I don't think.
Nowhere
near. We're being outspent by a massive amount, and we're concerned that there's the appearance anyway, and that's why we're asking for this investigation, that there was improper use of state resources, legislative resources, the resources of the Speaker and President's office, to help bring in some of that money that is now being used against.
Thank you. I think Mr. Martin has something he'd like to say on this.
Sure. Thank you for the question. We're getting close to election time, quite frankly, and I suspect there's going to be a lot more interesting news stories that may or may not have any merit. We certainly are for full disclosure and transparency in government. We are certainly for appropriate use of public resources and public spaces. I, myself, and I'm sure Mr. Bowen and others, routinely attend meetings at the state capitol. That's what that building is for conducting the people's work and having access to your legislators. My understanding, and I appreciate the fact that Mr. Bowen pointed, characterized it in the way that he did, which was, it seems. I was also made aware of this as I came up this afternoon, and so I called somebody in the campaign office and said, what's the deal here? Because obviously, you know, I'm putting my reputation at risk a little bit if I'm associated with something that doesn't seem completely above board. The response I was given, and I certainly have confidence in it, is that they actually talked to people who were in that meeting and confirmed that there was no impropriety in terms of someone suggesting or asking for money. Correlation is not causality. Just because you're in a meeting with somebody, or, great example, just because Colorado has Tabor and Colorado has grown in its economy doesn't mean that Tabor was the cause of that. Just because you have a meeting with somebody and they happen to, after that meeting, contribute to a campaign at some point in time after the fact doesn't mean that at that meeting you asked for a contribution. So my understanding from talking to folks at the campaign is that this likely is much to do about nothing, and will certainly, in any respect, resolve itself, and as well it should. But I suspect that this is not the last of kind of things along these lines that we're going to see as this campaign winds down.
Thank you. Does anybody else on the panel have something that they'd like to add to this?
Sure, I'll make a couple of comments. This is David Crocker. We actually requested Attorney General Mills today to undertake an investigation of the illegal use of legislative computer systems by legislative staff to solicit contributions. And under the Freedom of Information Act request, we received documents actually last Friday, which we parsed over the weekend. And quite frankly, we put together a very compelling story showing that it appears, again, I'll use that word that everyone seems to like, it appears to be a pay-to-play type of situation where members of the construction and transportation and engineering community were brought in by invitation to this closed-door meeting, and they were informed in a way that seems compelling that their support to defeat Tabor would be, quote, in their best interest, and that they should help do what it takes to defeat Tabor, and that there were certain things in it for them if Tabor were defeated. We think it's a serious matter. It's not a matter of frivolity for us. It's a very grave sort of thing to make that kind of discovery, and to take the step of asking the Attorney General to look into it. So I would object that it's not just some kind of campaign ploy. Actually, you know, our polling numbers have been pretty good. It's not desperate for us, but it's something that the public needs to know.
Thank you. Mr. Perry, did you have a comment you'd like to add to this?
I really don't know much of anything about this situation, but I do know every person involved so far that I've heard. I know what legislative leadership does. When you're in legislative leadership, that's all you do, practically, is meet with people all day long. Private citizens, special interest groups, construction groups, whoever. That's what they do. They meet with people constantly when we're in session and when we're out. That's what I do in my office, in my committee room, you know, wherever. So those things go on routinely. Roads, if it's a road construction group, they're funded by the state. I think it makes it very prudent to have a discussion about what may happen if Tabor passes or if it doesn't with the interested parties. I would think if money is involved, it's the construction folks who would it would be coming from them, because they know, I think they know, overrides just, when are we going to spend $1.6 million to go up a penny on the gas tax to build roads? Not likely. So they have an interest. So having discussions, no problem. Absolutely appropriate. I would be shocked if state computers were used to look for money. I got no problem with asking the AG. If that's going on, we ought to know about it. But knowing the people involved, I find it extraordinarily hard to believe that anything improper went on other than a run-of-the-mill meeting that goes on all the time about Tabor and what it may mean to people. But I will be shocked if anything comes out of this beyond that.
Thank you. We have another question from the audience. Can you identify yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Gray. I'm from Hancock. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I'd like to, during this discussion, I've noticed from Mr. Bowen and Mr. Crocker several assumptions. One is that the growth in state government has somehow, the growth in state spending has somehow made big government. Isn't it also possible that some of the growth in spending is due to funding that used to come from the federal government that now has to be provided by the state or is channeled through the state, and that it isn't necessarily our taxes that are going up? And also, basically what I want to ask you is, if you were going to have your heart operated on, would you want the cheapest doctor or the medium-priced doctor, or would you want the best doctor you could get, regardless of the price? And shouldn't government services are not interchangeable commodities like a particular brand of thumbtacks. It's a lot of different stuff. It takes a lot of expertise and knowledge and studying to understand it all. We elect representatives to do that. People in referendums often vote only their narrow self-interest rather than the communal good. And don't we want a government that's not the least expensive we can get, but the best we can get? And I just don't see how Tabor is going to help us towards that. And I'd like, anybody who wants a response, welcome.
Yeah, I'll go ahead. First, with regard to the federal funding, I mean, I haven't been in the legislature for a couple of years, so I haven't tracked. We have Senator Rosen here, thankfully, who can answer that question, but I haven't tracked what's happened to our federal funding. I know that Maine is a net receiver of federal funds. In other words, we get more back from the federal government than we pay to the federal government. So we're a net receiver of other people's tax money from other states. To the extent to which that's changed, I don't know. I haven't been watching it carefully, but I do know we've got received piles of stimulus money from the stimulus bill. With regard to government, I don't think anybody's advocating for the cheapest possible government. I would be satisfied with right in the middle, with average. I would be satisfied with, you know, if we could get our levels of spending on Medicaid and food stamps and those kind of things down from being the very highest in the country. We're the highest in the country, down to closer to the national average, spending on other things closer to the national average. And as a consequence of that, having incomes that are closer to the national average than they are today. You know, we've been talking a little bit about Colorado. And the growth of incomes in Colorado has been staggering, and I dispute that Tabor has had no effect on that, and the raising of incomes, which creates general prosperity, which gives people better jobs, which gives them access to health care, which gives them access, you know, people who have higher incomes have better health, they have more access to education. I mean, that's what we want to do, is grow incomes. And incomes, I'll just give you a couple. We haven't done a lot of data dumping on you yet, but I'll give you this one. In the 10 years before Tabor, total employment in Colorado went up 18.1%. In the 10 years after Tabor in Colorado, total employment went up 34.6%. Now, maybe it's a coincidence that something happened in 1992 besides Tabor that resulted in a dramatic increase in job creation in Colorado. Government sector employment stayed about the same, about 20% in the 10 years before Tabor and the 10 years after Tabor. So government continued to grow. Government employment continued to grow. More people got government jobs. That all continued to grow. Government spending continued to grow in Colorado. But private sector employment in the 10 years prior to Tabor was 17.5%. In the 10 years after Tabor, it was 37.7%, 10 years either side. So we would argue that there's clearly something that happened there. And so, you know, we, and the other thing that's happened is the growth of incomes. You know, Colorado was like, I want to say 18th or 19th in 1992 in terms of where it ranked in the all states in its per capita personal income. And by the year 2000, 2001, it was up in the top 10. It was like 7th. Maine, our per capita personal income was 35th in the nation in 1992, and it's 35th today. It's a flat line. We've made no progress on this course that we've been on, growing the incomes of our people and raising their general prosperity. And so, you know, I just don't see, I see a vote against Tabor as almost, let's just keep going down the path we've been going on. And I just don't see where the end point is. I don't see where this is going. We've got one of the highest tax burden in the country. We've got more people on government programs than almost any other state. Our schools were spending in the top 10 per pupil spending. Our schools are not producing the kind of results we need to. We're not producing enough college graduates, even though we increased spending in higher ed and we have this massive higher education system. I just don't see how we're getting any closer to a more prosperous future. If there was a model out there of a state that taxed and spent its way to prosperity, I'd be happy to look at that. But I don't see a state where that's happened. So I think You develop Tabor to allow government to live within its means. You have a valve there. If people want to spend more, they're welcome to do that. And over time, you're going to grow the general prosperity. That's what happened in Colorado, and that's what happened to other states like New Hampshire and other states where they have been very careful about growing tax burdens and the size of government. And we see that as a much better route to prosperity than the path we're on today.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Make no mistake, and I'm going to respond to his comment perhaps more so than your question, but Tabor is a bad idea. And I think it's interesting, the comments earlier about we need to have a discussion about our priorities in the state. And to me, a discussion of priorities is one that takes an honest view of what works and what doesn't work. And to listen to the argument, it sounds like if we cut our taxes to zero, we would have phenomenal growth. I don't think that's working in Madagascar or wherever
average,
else.
I said. I didn't say bottom. Average is what
but
I said.
That said, I don't deny that taxes are an important piece of the equation, but there are certainly much more important pieces that we're not even talking about here. And it's unfortunate that we, as a state, are being dragged down this path again to review a bad idea that we threw out before. Now, I just want to speak to two points that I think will address this issue. One, in the depiction of the data, There was something interesting that happened there. In reporting on income levels, what was the date that he stopped? 2001. Now, between 2000 and 2006, Maine's growth in personal incomes exceeded that of Colorado's. The other thing that's interesting is it's always about Colorado, Colorado, Colorado in isolation. Well, between 1992 and 2007, growth in personal income as a percentage figure, there were some states that exceeded Colorado. States like Massachusetts, states like Vermont, states like Wyoming, which I would argue is perhaps more similar, states like Louisiana. So the point I'm trying to make is that we're being sold a bad bill of goods here. And if we believe that Tabor is a cure to all our ills, I think we're sadly mistaken, and unfortunately we're not having the conversation to address and identify the issues that really do matter in this state, and that we as a community and as a state need to target our public dollars so that we can prosper and grow and flourish in a way that makes sense, and not in a way that's driven by some misguided ideology that has been proven time and again by economists to have no grounded bearing in long-term prospects of growth and prosperity. Think about it again. Vermont, Massachusetts, South Dakota, Wyoming, Texas, Louisiana, all outstripped Colorado. They didn't have Tabor mechanisms. They had other choices that they made that matter. Those are the choices we should be making in this state. Tabor is not the answer.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the audience who's planning to ask a question? I'm sure we can. Thank you. You want to come up to the microphone, identify yourself, please?
My name's Andy. I live in Bucksport. I don't know all the ins and outs of all this. I'm still learning. I'm not set on which way I'm going to vote yet. But I'm just listening to both sides. And I ask myself, each one of us, as times get hard, we all put some guidelines on our own personal budgets of how we want to spend. And it helps us through those hard times and helps us prosper in prosperous times by having some guidelines of how we're going to spend our money and where we're going to put it. To me, Tabor seems like guidelines to help us do that. And another thing, too, is that the last number of years here, we've had Tabor's come up several different times, been voted down several different times, and we've gone the same way we've gone before. But when you do the same thing over and over and over again and expect different results, that doesn't happen. You can't do the same thing over and over and over again and expect a different result the next time you do it. You need to make a change.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in on that. David Crocker speaking. I view the people who are against Tabor, frankly, as defending a failed status quo. They are asking us to do more of the same, which demonstrably does not work. I've watched Maine get older and poorer. I do not view Tabor as a magic bullet that's going to solve every problem. Oh, no. I believe that it is the beginning of a salvage operation of Maine's economy. Because that's the point where we're at right now. We are in a salvage operation to save Maine's economy. Because it's not getting better, folks. You know, to my worthy adversaries here in the panel, take a good look around you in the state of Maine. How's it working out for you? Do you actually think that going on and doing more of the same is going to improve things? I agree with Andy. Only by taking stock and by doing something different, by putting constraints in place, by imposing disciplines on ourselves, is the situation going to change. My stepdaughter is in university in Colorado. She'll never be back. You want to know why? Because Colorado is vibrant, it's prosperous, and it's on the move. People move to Colorado not
on a whim. They move because there are economic opportunities there. She sees it, and she sees no future here in the state of Maine. She comes home, and she sees a lot of old people. Let's be candid. I'm no spring chicken myself. Let's just keep on doing what we're doing. It seems to be working out just fine.
Mr. Perry?
Thank you. Well, I would agree we're in a salvage operation. We're in a salvage operation of this entire economy. Not the main economy, not so much different than the national economy is in crisis right now. And we're spending less money on the state level today than we were in 2006 when voters rejected Tabor the last time. So I don't see how Tabor is the answer. Now, I don't disagree that everyone on this panel and in this auditorium, and I suspect listening somewhere, we all have the same goals. We want a prosperous state of Maine. We want it better for our kids than it was for us. We want a bright future. But somehow it seems like we look at the problems we have here in the state of Maine that are the same problems that are all over the country, and we try to own them as our own and blame ourselves for them. Does anyone remember Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in the primaries when they were in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, all these other manufacturing states, and how badly they're hurting, worse than us, okay? We had a manufacturing economy here we could depend on for years. And you might say it was NAFTA, you might say it's China, worldwide competition, but the economy we could count on for years and years is changing drastically. The mill here in Bucksport's tenuous, okay? It's been a great employer here in Bucksport for years. I hope it has a bright future. But the economy's changing, and we don't own these problems. It's something we've created on the state level, and Tabor's not going to fix it. From the Heritage Policy Center's own report, it says Maine government spends too much. That's their opinion. They may be right. I don't know. And this decision to spend the money directly creates higher taxes. All right, fine. Well, if that's the case and they're right, why not have a simple override mechanism on spending? Why tie our hands on 700 other special revenue funds? You know, they take the Racino and Bangor. They fund, that was passed by Citizens Initiative, and part of it, they fund scholarships to the University of Maine. If they have a busy month or a busy year,
1 minute, please.
That goes over the Tabor limit. And we have to spend $1.6 million on a referendum to find out if we can fund these, or if we can't, we have to figure out who the gamblers were and give the money back to them. I mean, that's what Tabor does. If it was simply an override mechanism on spending, it wouldn't be so bad. Everything else would take care of itself. But I see it as something strictly designed to tie the hands of government and confound the whole works.
Mr. Bowen.
Thank you. I just want to respond to the question that the senator's brought up a couple times about why these other revenue funds. The other revenue funds are included because of what happened when LD1 was put into place. And you'll recall that back along when we turned down these initiatives and we were told we'd all take care of it, they passed LD1. And LD1 put this cap in place that we weren't going to grow general fund spending beyond this cap. Well, one of the things that happened was this. Because we were ramping up education funding, the new money from the state that went into the general purpose aid account at the Department of Education, which then goes out to the schools, was immune from the cap. In other words, you could put an endless amount of money into that, well, not as much money as you possibly could, into that general purpose aid account, and that money did not count against that cap. So what happened? Well, shockingly, the Department of Education started funding Department of Education positions in Augusta using funding from the general purpose aid account, which is supposed to go out to the school districts. Why did they do that? Because when they moved the funding of those positions out of their general fund account into their general purpose aid account, it lowered the general fund artificially and moved that money to the general purpose aid account where it wasn't accounted against the cap. So they essentially used that process to evade the LD1 cap. And so the reason these other funds are included is to prevent precisely that from happening, which is the legislature can move money from any account to any other account. It can move into other special revenue funds. It can clean out other special revenue funds. It can move money any place. And the concern was if we cap the general fund, then what do you think is going to happen? What they're going to do is they're going to start dipping into other funds and moving funds all over the place. Because we have a spending problem. And I understand what Senator Perry's talking about not recently we don't have a spending, but it's not as though they've seen the light on spending. They don't have the money. That's why they're not spending. It's not that they woke up and said, well, we can't continue to spend like this. They don't have the money to spend. So you need to go back to the late 90s when they did have money to spend to see what they do when they do have it. And what they do is they spend it. There's a four-year period between 1996 and 2000 where they were increasing general fund spending 10% a year, four times the rate of inflation, 4 years straight, a 40% increase in general fund spending. Why? Because the revenue was pouring. It was the late 90s. Stock market was booming. Revenue was pouring through the windows of the State House. And what did they do? They spent it.
Thank you.
So the concern is, what are they going to do when they have the money? Now they don't have the money to spend, so they're not spending it. When they do have it, they'll spend it, unless you have a taper provision in place.
Thanks. We're going to have one brief comment on this from Mr. Martin, and then we have one final questioner.
Andy, thanks for your question, and I hope you got your money's worth, at least, in terms of things to cogitate on. I think your point is an interesting one in terms of having some boundaries. And if that's something that one feels is important, what I would suggest, and certainly what our experience here in Maine even suggests, is that the formula that is being proposed is not the right formula. With LD1, there was a process of deliberation whereby at the legislature there was a concerted effort to really evaluate different measures that could be used to sort of inform our and guide our decisions around funding. Ultimately, the formula that's being proposed for Tabor was soundly identified as not the way to go, and so it's a very different formula. Again, if you think about what government purchases, the services it purchases, think about in your own life, healthcare, roads or translate automobiles, and think about fuel prices. Those things tend to grow at a rate that's much greater than this consumer price index or the rate of inflation. So I'm sympathetic to the desire to see some parameters so there's predictability and confidence in what's going on there. But even that being the case, I would suggest that the formula that's proposed here is not a formula that makes sense. And as a result, I would say still there's yet another reason to vote no on question four. So thank you.
Thanks. We have one final audience member who's been patiently waiting.
My name's David. Sorry, I have a very bad cold today. I'm an independent. I still haven't made up my mind on Tabor, by the way. I'm going to make a couple comments on the question. You'll each kind of recognize yourselves in there and maybe respond to it. Mr. Martin, in your answer, you listed in discussing income taxes six or seven different states. I know for a fact that six of those states, or all but one of them for sure, have lower income tax rates than the state of Maine. I don't know for a fact about Louisiana or not. I suspect it's lower, but I don't know that for a fact. Mr. Perry, you mentioned New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut in one of your answers. Maine has a higher income tax than those three states. So in your answers, you're responding to, what are the common points. The common points I see, and it's not this easy, but is the state of Maine has very, very high marginal income tax rates. Mm-hmm. It's killing this state. When I, 30 years ago, people in Maine who were middle class, didn't have a college education, would try to get a job working for a paper company or a public utility. Now they try to get a government job. And I think I remember the famous statements of President Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. What we have in Maine is a governmental municipal employee union contractor complex, and it's killing the state. And regardless of how this incident with Tabor goes, something really dramatic has to change. I work in a financial field. This week, I've spoken to three different people, make between $75,000 and $200,000 who've left this state to work in Connecticut, Mississippi, and elsewhere. Anyway.
Do you have a question?
Well,
or were you just making an observation?
I'd like them to respond to the tax argument that particularly Mr. Martin made an indication that that taxes were not that relevant, but I think your list disproves your argument, Mr. Martin.
Thank you very much. Mr. Perry had indicated that he would like to respond, and then we'll funnel it to Mr. Martin.
I love that question, because for years we've been branded the highest tax state in the nation.
We're running really short on time, so you have to really be concise with your language.
We've got about a minute. We've had that label. Come and find out we're essentially the national average. Since I've been in the legislature, we've cut four. If you take the numbers from the Tax Foundation, they have us at 0.3% higher than the national average. There's a group of a dozen or more states right around the national average. They're the ones who had us at number one. They admitted they weren't calculating properly. We're 0.3 by their ranking above the national average. And I can guarantee you, while we're balancing our budget by cutting, and every other state's raising taxes, we'll be at or below the national average next year. That's my prediction. But since I've been there, we've cut the sales tax from 6% to 5%. We created your homestead exemption. We doubled the circuit breaker program. We funded the Better Business Tax Reimbursement Program from $6 million to $80 million a year. We repealed the personal property tax on business equipment. We've put $800 million new money into education because the voters told us to, and we're going to have a hard time keeping up with that in this recession. Pine tree zones, dozens of targeted tax breaks. We just passed tax reform this year to drop that top marginal rate from 8.5% to 6.5% because it is a problem. It sticks out like a sore thumb. We're moving in that direction because we recognize it's a necessity.
Thanks, Mr. Martin. Did you have something you'd like to say?
Well, I think it's a great question, and I would unfortunately, I don't, off the top of my head, have all the figures on what the variable.
You've got about 1 minute before
tax rates
have to wrap
are.
It up.
What I think is important to acknowledge is, you know, I think we can all, at an individual level, state that we'd prefer to pay less in taxes. I mean, but that happens everywhere. I think what's important for us as a state is to recognize that taxes aren't bad, taxes aren't good, taxes are a tool. I suspect that those states have invested the tax proceeds differently than we have, and I suspect that there are greater lessons to be learned from that. The other thing, though, I will acknowledge is that there is a recognition that our tax structure in this state needs some serious modification, and that effort was put into play during the last legislative session. It was an effort that's been commended by the Wall Street Journal, and I suspect, hopefully, we'll have a positive impact on the friends of yours who you indicated moved away from the state.
So. Why don't we take about 30 seconds each for a wrap-up before we end?
I was just going to say that there's a study out that you should look at called called Rich States, Poor States, and pieces of the data in there show that I don't have the number right, but I want to say, you may know, David, more than I do, it's 1,200 or 1,600 people a day move from a high tax state to a low tax state. Right. We know the tax burden affects prosperity. And yes, is the marginal income tax rate going down in this plan? Yeah, because you're all going to pay more sales taxes. Okay, they're going to take it out of your back pocket instead of taking it out of your front pocket. That's what tax reform in Augusta is all about. Right. We'll just rearrange the deck chairs. Tabor is real change, and it's going to force people to make the decisions that we've been putting off making.
Thank you.
About how we live within our means.
Thank you. Amy, have we used up our time?
No, I was just trying to get him to move on because we have 30 seconds each.
Okay.
Listen, you know, tax reform lowers burden by $57 million. It's one small piece of the puzzle. We're modernizing the tax code, and we're lowering the one that stands out. I mean, it's an important thing to do. It's not going to change anyone's life, $150 in people's pocket. And yes, we are collecting other sales taxes to offset that. But it's the right thing to do. Tabor, if it was a simple referendum on spending, fine, maybe it makes sense. The rest of it, it's going to make it too hard to operate. We're going to waste too much money trying to comply.
Thanks, Mr. Crocker.
Yes, David Crocker, very concisely. Look, what Tabor does is it creates predictability. And in order for business to thrive, you have to have predictability. I know this. I work with entrepreneurs. In order for people to risk their capital, to put it to work, there has to be an assurance that government will live within its means. Only with predictability will people risk the kind of money that it takes to build an economy. And it's not happening in Maine because businesses are viewed as an ATM.
Thank you. Garrett. The final word goes to Mr. Martin.
Well, I'm optimistic that Maine as a state is a state that can and will chart a path towards greater prosperity. I don't believe that Tabor is the way. I don't believe that Tabor is part of that path. We think it was a bad idea before, and it's a bad idea now. And this is the absolute worst time to enact something like this. It will undermine our prosperity for the future. As Charlie Colgan, an economist, has stated, Tabor is a vote for permanent recession in the state of Maine.
Thank you. Amy?
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, everyone. You've been listening to a live broadcast forum on Tabor 2. We'd like to thank our panelists this evening, Garrett Martin, Steve Bowen, Senator Joe Perry, and David Crocker, as well as the moderator, Chris Covert. Behind the scenes, Joel Mann, Chris Stark, Sylvia Smith, Willie Marquardt, Matt Murphy, and Adam Locker have been putting the program together as well. I'd like to thank our studio audience here as and we have a watering can at the back. I'm getting a signal to remind you that that's there if you would like to make a donation or just touch the famous watering can from our pledge drive. And those